What's up, everyone? Welcome to Sports Card Madness, the podcast that covers the entire collectible space, including sports cards, business, technology, and more. Now brought to you in partnership with Fanatics Live.
I've traveled to Hong Kong, Singapore, a lot of countries. I've appraised collections upwards of $75 to $100 million.
Now there's a sale by Merck underneath the DJ.
Kick is on the way, and it is good! It's good!
5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
What's up, everyone? I'm Nick, and I'm here with LZ as usual. And today we have a really cool guest, Michael Osaki. He is an appraiser. I believe he's the head appraiser or lead appraiser for PSA. And we're really excited to have him to the pod because this was something that I, in particular, didn't really know about. And my insurance company told me that I needed for my valuable cards. So I reached out to Mike and he's going to appraise my stuff. But then I thought, hey, let's get on the air and help the audience out and just kind of walk through, you know, some of the things you do. So, Michael, welcome to the pod. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. So to Nick's point, I'm very interested in what you do. I'm always interested in especially just vocations and in different jobs that I really know nothing about. And I really think this is going to provide a lot of service to our listeners. So I really just wanted to start with you and your story and just how you became an appraiser. And then kind of secondly, like what even is an appraiser would be a good way to start.
Sure. I got started in the 1990s when my grandfather got me a shoebox of old baseball cards for my birthday. And back then, card shows were at local hotels, Ramada Inn, Marriott. And it was interesting to me as I walked the show floor, you'd have dozens or sometimes hundreds of dealers. They were all buying and selling, or sometimes even trading, but no one was appraising. Even though there were signs that said free appraisal, you know, there was a clear a conflict of interest there. And that didn't make sense to me when you had a suitcase of, let's say, cards, and you plop it down on the dealer's table and say, you know, what do I have here? How much is this worth? And the dealer says, I'll give you $5,000. Well, is that an appraisal? He's trying to buy it so he can resell it. And I saw this time and time again across the country. And that was really eye-opening. And so fast forward to today, yes, I am a certified sports appraiser. I'm the head appraiser of PSA, which is the world's largest third-party grader of sports collectibles. Generally speaking, people will call me in for one of three reasons. Insurance, donation, or estate planning purposes.
Are you, so going backwards, you kind of discovered that there was a kind of a niche to be filled in the collectible space. Were you like one of the first to do this? Is it, were you kind of one of the pioneers in doing sports collectible appraising?
Maybe. I mean, it's possible. I mean, yeah. There were, and even today, they're like, you get like, you know, how many mortgage brokers do you know? 150. How many realtors do you know? 1 million. How many car salesmen? 1 million. You know, how many sports appraisers? Maybe you know one. That's me.
I know yeah, one.
Exactly. I had a very hard time. My insurance company said, Nick, I can't insure this stuff. You need an appraiser. I'm like, well, where do I do that? You know, that's not in the yellow pages. That's not, I Googled and I don't know where I heard about you, but it was, you know, a sports card podcast or something. So I agree. You are like a ghost. It's crazy.
Yes. Oh yes. Yeah. We're very lucky to have you on. How did you get connected with PSA and become their lead appraiser?
Yeah. So this process started, 6 or 7 years ago. This was before they were acquired and taken private. Back then, they were a publicly traded company. And they wanted to open up an appraisal division and appraisal service, because what was happening is after a customer would get their order or orders back from PSA, whether it's a card or an autograph or a ticket stub, a lot of times the customer would say, "This is awesome. It's a seven. How much is this worth?" And they would call PSA and say, "Well, tell us more about this." And PSA would be like, "Huh? Who are you? Like, it's a seven. Like, we can't help you." They'd be like, "Huh? We just paid you money. Just tell us how much it's worth." And PSA would say, "What?" And so it's like this weird conversation, right? And so it made sense as a value add to their service. After something has been graded or authenticated, I can take a look at it, and the customer can pay a fee, and I write up a letter, just like a letter of authenticity, that says what it's worth. And so PSA back then did their due diligence for actually a couple of years. They interviewed every appraiser they could find, background checks, connections, not just on me, but they, you know, all these other people too, who they were thinking about bringing on. And so long story short is they chose me, and it's a feather in my cap, and I'm very honored to, you know, have that title and be affiliated with PSA. And the new ownership kept me on, and I'm still there. It's been, what, I guess 3 years next week, I guess, that the new ownership acquired PSA. So, but as far as my own company, Baseball in the Attic, nothing has to be graded or authenticated in order for me to appraise it. In fact, most of the stuff I see is raw. And so I travel a lot, 150 days at least every year, reviewing collections. Usually these are larger collections. And as I stated, there's usually three reasons for that.
Okay. All right. What's the percentage between, like, how much you're working on your side versus PSA calling you in to do some special appraisal?
I would say it depends by month. And there is some seasonality to the business. Generally speaking, you know, March and April, really April is the single busiest month year after year for two reasons. One, the start of baseball, opening day, and also, more importantly, this unofficial start of spring cleaning season. Oh. as the weather starts to turn across the country. And so for 6 months, well, 5 months, some places, you know, unfortunately people have passed away or whatever, and they're starting to go through garages, barns, attics, garages, crawl spaces. And they say, you know what, holy cow, you know, Uncle Johnny, you know, has this huge card collection, and maybe now is a good time to get it checked out.
Wow. I never thought of that seasonality. That's right. Spring cleaning. And then you start finding stuff. That's wild. Right.
You must see, and we'll get into it. We're probably going to spend a whole section on this, but you must see some just incredible collections. And I'm a bit envious with that, actually, that just kind of your experiences that you get to go through. Let's say tomorrow I decide I'm quitting my full-time job. I want to become an appraiser. How do I start? What sort of training do I need? Apprenticeships, internships? How do I get into this business?
Well, the first thing is you have to become familiar with the hobby, cards, autographs. Maybe you have a specialty or general interest in, let's say, autographs. Well, you got to get your hands dirty. A lot of people got their start at auction houses, and that's a good way. You know, I never did that. And today, some of my auction houses are my clients. You know, when you see an auction estimate of $1 million, sometimes they'll call me and say, you know, hey, you know, internally we think it's $1 million. What do you think this will sell for? And so you just gotta, you know, get your hands dirty and just walk, go to as many shows as possible and touch things, see what things are, you know, touch a raw card, take it out of the case. Is this fake? Is this real? That's the best way to do it.
Makes sense. A lot of hands-on training. Got it.
Wow.
Okay.
That's, that's pretty cool. I mean, basically just, get dirty and find stuff out. So what's, Michael, what is the most valuable collection that you've ever appraised, like an actual collection or maybe card or something like that?
Yeah. So I'm lucky to have appraised the finest and best collections in the world. I've traveled to Hong Kong, Singapore, a lot of countries. Wow. I've appraised collections upwards of $75 to $100 million. And one of the reasons why people call me is due to confidentiality, right? These people don't want to know. These people don't want to know that they have this, you know, at home or in their bank or whatever it is in their office. And so, I take that very seriously. You know, I work with a lot of athletes, baseball owners, professional sports franchise owners, museums. And so if God forbid I share on social media what I'm looking at, what I'm appraising at, my entire career could be in jeopardy. And so when you follow me on Instagram at Sports Appraisals, you know, I do post some stuff, but and I try and educate people too, but I don't really post what I'm actually appraising because I have to sign off on NDAs. There's always lawyers involved with my appraisals.
Wow. I mean, here I am thinking I've got a pretty nice collection, you know, but then you're like, yeah, you know, I went to Tokyo and wherever, and I've seen $100 million collections. I have no doubt. I can only imagine what's in those things. That's just so cool. What's your favorite thing that you've seen in all your travels that you can talk about, like favorite card or something like that? Or what's like the coolest thing you've come across?
Well, in 2017, Forbes magazine named me the Dean of Cracker Jack baseball cards. And so I love looking at Cracker Jack baseball cards. I know a lot about them. When people find them, I'm usually like the first call. They were only issued in 2 years, 1914 and 1915. And that's always a favorite of mine. I skew vintage over modern. So, you know, 33 Gaudi set, that's a great set. There's four Babe Ruth cards in that set. It's littered with Hall of Famers. I've appraised countless of Babe Ruth autographs, including his quite possibly last known autograph that he signed on his deathbed. So it kind of runs the gamut. I don't know if I have a favorite, but those are some things that kind of pop in my head right now.
Those are great. Wow. I'm going to spin it a different way from Nick's question. So those are probably maybe some of your favorites. What about, do you ever come across, I'm sure you probably do, just like obscure collections, like you walk in, or maybe they give you a heads up on what you're going to be looking at, and you finally walk in and meet them and you're like, wow, this is very different. Is there any obscure collections, anything that shocked you?
We hope you guys are enjoying this episode. LZ and I have a big ask for everyone. If you are enjoying the show every week, please take a few seconds to go on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and follow us. If you can leave a 5-star review, that would be really amazing and help keep the pod coming every Friday and Tuesday. Thanks, everyone. Now back to the show.
No, never, because I do a lot of upfront work. I have to choose carefully who I work with. Right? I travel every day, and to be honest, most of my job is delivering bad news, meaning this autograph is fake, this card is a reprint, I don't want to work with you, or your collection isn't valuable enough to work with you. So like, I know when, as soon as I step foot in the door, exactly what I'm going to be looking for or looking at usually. Yes, there are some odds and ends because people don't have a complete inventory, but no. And I only do sports. I don't do music or entertainment. So, that doesn't happen and will never happen.
Okay. All right. So you mentioned you're traveling a lot, right? I assume, you know, you're going to people's homes or their offices or some location to look at these. What does it take for you to actually travel? Like what you mentioned, there is probably a dollar figure that it's got to be worth it for you and the person who's getting it appraised. What is that limit for you?
There's no limit, you know.
Okay, again, there isn't. Okay,
because I get calls and emails every day, and so I just, if it's something that I want to appraise, that's super valuable, then I'll do it.
Okay.
But, you know, most people in this country have items and they want to know what the value is. Unfortunately, you know, my business is not set up to just, you know, answer all 100 calls I get every day to say that this, you know, Joe Montana jersey is worth $150. It's, yeah, it's just,
right.
Most people can just go on eBay and look at sold listings, which, by the way, speaking of education, that's a great tool, sold listings. Unfortunately, you know, people don't want to click on sold listings because they only want to see offers. Okay. I have a house. If I want to, I can list it for $100 million, but maybe it's only worth $500,000. That's what I care about. Unfortunately, people will call me and say, oh my God, my card's on eBay for $100 million. I'm so wealthy. And I have to tell them like the bad news and they don't believe me and they don't understand how that works.
Bravo.
Yes.
Bravo, Michael. I probably talk about this every third episode. Every third episode.
Sold tab.
We bring this up. Click on the sold tab. Remember the sold tab.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's crazy. Yeah, it's interesting. I actually, you know, just following on that, how do you value something when there is no public data? So, for example, I deal in a lot of obscure vintage cards, vintage autograph cards, sets that there are like four of in the world, stuff like that. How do you go about appraising something like that? You know, like something that there is no sold on eBay.
Yeah. Then that's actually what I get called on, you know, on a weekly basis. I have to put values on one of one items, whether it's a game used jersey or a Kobe Bryant 101 card or, you know, I have to think it through. So for example, let's say it's a Mickey Mantle All-Star game used bat. Okay, well, what year is it from? Is it from 56? That's his triple crown, you know, year. So that's very significant. But let's say there's no comps, but maybe I find a Joe DiMaggio game used bat. So again, playing the Yankees. Joe DiMaggio didn't play in the mid-50s because he was well retired many years prior, but you know, maybe it's from, you know, 1950, you know, what does it look like? You know, what does the game use look like? When did that trade, you know, was it at auction house? Was it on eBay? I can't use any comps. Well, I can't use any comps pre-COVID, which now it's been 4 years, but really in my world, last 12 months is where I like to look at. So I kind of try and find something as a starting point or a jumping off point to kind of, you know, just initially tell me, is this $10,000? Is it $100,000? Is it worthless? Is it $1 million? And then from there, start to hone in on, okay, let's look at a condition. What does that look like? What are some other, you know, game used bats, some all-star game used bats? What have they sold for from different players and different teams that are less caliber? So it's kind of like a chess match to kind of like pull pieces apart and put them together and move them around and kind of see what we kind of come up with.
Very interesting. Cool.
So Michael, sorry, Nick, I got to ask one more question. I just thought of something. So Michael, if we go back to your example with the bat, do you have like a toolbox of maybe other experts that are coming in? And let's say the owner claims that the bat is from, I don't know, 1965. Like, are you able to tell that it's from 1965? Like, how do you know? Like, a card is probably easier, right? Because there's the date on it and you can probably understand if it's counterfeit. But maybe with a bat, like, how do you know? How do you know it's from that year?
Yeah, so sometimes yes and sometimes no. You know, I have PBOR, which is Professional Bat Order Records. But maybe for a future episode, what you guys should do is call John Taube, who's the bat authenticator at PSA. You know, he's like, that's all he does is just game used bats.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Cool. So Michael, when you show up, you know, you go to appraise something, I imagine some people are looking to take that appraisal and they may not just be insuring it like me, but then maybe they want to sell it. Who knows, could be part of an estate sale or something like that. Have you ever been really challenged, not just like sort of challenged, but aggressively challenged on an opinion. And if things ever gotten crazy where somebody's like tried to bribe you or, you know, just try to do something like that.
All of it. Yeah. Most of the appraisals that I do are not for sale. Things that will never be for sale that are going to be passed down to, you know, different generations. But even so, yeah, there's some times where I'll, you know, so for example, the 86 Fleer MJ Rookie PSA 10 that's been volatile. You know, we saw during COVID, it hit the peak at, you know, January 31st, 2021, which I called the top on my Instagram. I said, watch out down below. And then I get a call the next couple weeks. No, it was a week later from Sotheby's. And they go, they have a client who I'm not going to name because everyone listening knows this person. It says, my client has that card. It just sold for $728,000, you know, last week. I go, yeah, that's correct. And they go, okay, so my client, you know, is asking like $700,000. I said, no, that's not where the market is right now. The market's at 600 grand. Yeah, what do you mean? It's only been 7 days. I go, no, it's 600 grand. I go, in 24 hours, it's 575 grand. Every day that ticks by, and they didn't know, they were so confused. They thought I was like blowing smoke up their butt. And, you know, then it finally sold for like, you know, I don't know, a month later for like, you know, 550 grand. I get a call back. Okay, client wants to sell for 550 grand. I go, no, it's 450 grand right now. You know, what are you talking about? And so long story short, my contact at Sotheby's left. And I bumped into this person at Sotheby's about a year and a half later. And they said, my client still has that card. And here we are today. It's, you know, it's $150,000, $200,000 card. So because I look at not just price action, but volume as well. I have a financial trading background. And so I understand not just sentimentality and how emotions play into, but also volume. Volume is very important. So at that price point, there were two of them that sold at $728,000. And then that same, within 24 hours, two more sold at private. So four of them sold. That's the peak. That's it. It's over. And then the rest is history. But anyways, I got off point, but I got kind of excited there because that's just one example. And there's other examples that I have like that too, where people want to sell because they see something at auction sell and they want that price. Sometimes you can get that price, but sometimes you can't.
Michael, you are the man. I need to start following you if I'm not. Because you feel like Gordon Gekko on Wall Street in like a, you know, a sports card sort of way. Like you're just, that's really cool. I never thought of not only the pricing, and people always try to time, who's the peak, it's not the peak, but the volume. I never thought of that when it comes to sports cards. So that's brilliant. Very cool. Very cool. So I have one specific question on valuation. So let's take, I have something sort of unique. LZ's working on it. He's pretty close. I have the 1986 Fleer autograph set. It's fully slabbed, dual graded, PSA new label. The one exception is the Jordan that's in a BGS slab. I have the stickers as well. I also have some checklists signed by the referees and things like that. How would you, I mean, I'm not putting you on the spot to appraise this thing right now, but how would you go about doing that? Would you look at the cards individually? Or would you look at the set as a whole? Because, you know, these sets aren't, I know a couple that have sold privately and what the price is. I won't say it here. But like, how would you attack something like that?
Yeah. So the value will have to be determined on an individual basis. But let's say I was to write up the report, it would most likely be one large value with a couple of the key cards called out and those individual values, because this is like the 80-20 rule, where 20% of the cards have 80%, actually probably less. In the 86 Fleer set, it's, you know, it's the MJ, but there's a bunch of other good rookies too, and that's it. So, you know, those four or five cards represent maybe 90% of the value in that set. And so, you know, I would say, okay, the value of this set is XYZ, and these five cards are worth individually XYZ.
Yeah, that's great. It's it would be cool. Yeah, you sort of got the total price, but then it's like, we all know the MJs are driving it, right? That's the big one. But there's also deceased players, believe it or not. The second most expensive card in that set is not a Hall of Famer. It is somebody you've never heard of. There's actually three of them because they're just impossible to find. But
who is it?
So there's three cards in the 86 Fleer set that I call it the Holy Trinity. They really determine how many of these sets can exist. Dan Raunfeld is one. He retired the year after. So there was no like going to games and signing things. Mike Mitchell was a recluse, never signed. And then Derek Smith, who died in 1996. So there's 8 years to sign and then it's done. And people weren't even getting stuff signed back then. So, you know, my theory is that there's this maybe 25 Derek Smiths and addicts in existence on the planet. And that drives how many sets can be made. People know this too. So those three cards are more valuable than any Hall of Famer besides MJ. They're more valuable than Magic, Bird, Kareem, anybody in that set. Am I right, LZ?
Yes. Yes, you are. You are correct. Yes.
As he tries to build it and get
I'm
him
trying
Mike
to build
Mitchell
it. And it's like, oh, Nick, quiet down. Yeah. I need a couple of those. Be quiet.
Oh, those aren't great cards. Yeah. If you have them, send them our way. Yeah. So it's a fascinating set. As I built it, I kind of thought like you, and I was like, well, it's the Hall of Famers, right? But Hall of Famers, you know, everybody was getting Bird to sign stuff and Drexler to sign stuff. Nobody
Bird's
was going
still
after
signing. Magic still signing. Yeah. I mean, they sign every other week, it feels like, especially Bird lately. He's signing all over the place.
Nobody was going after Derek Smith, you know. Yeah. So when it comes to autographs, it's a little funky like that. That's why it was really cool to hear your perspective on it.
That's great. And you know, it's fun. That's a great set to collect. And that's generally speaking, like that's a great investment. You know, I don't usually advocate, you know, or tell people like or give them investment advice because I'm not an investment advisor, but you know, that's a good quality, you know, set to have and collect and just keep.
Yeah. That's going to my son. I'm not selling that. No. It'll be in the family for a long time.
Generations, hopefully. Same with mine. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Michael, so you've been doing this for a real long time. You mentioned some of the just massive collections that you've appraised. But I am curious, and thank you. It was great dovetail into what I wanted to talk to you about. So you mentioned like the 86 Fleer set, probably a good investment. What are just some other either cards or sets that over the years you've seen is just like it's kind of kept its value over the years or it's steadily gone up and not really kind of had these big peaks and valleys? Do any stand out in particular?
We hope you're enjoying this episode. If you want to connect with us and our community of listeners, please join our Facebook group, Sports Card Madness. The link is in the show notes. Share your collections, your stories, and your questions. Now back to the show.
Well, really, anything vintage. I mean, I guess if you guys want to stay in basketball, 57 Tops basketball, 61 Fleer basketball, you know, like, It drives me crazy that there's so much speculation in the hobby as it relates to modern cards. And it's essentially gambling. And I don't like it. I know people love it and they get, you know, and they get excited and you see these pack breaks and you see these crazy high prices. Like two and a half years ago, that Patrick Mahomes card sold it for $4.3 million at the I think the day before the National. And since then, he's won two Super Bowls. And that card is what? Worth $1.5 million, $2 million? I don't know, you know. And so you got to be careful. But vintage is great. It just slowly, you know, it's kind of it's like the S&P 500. It just slowly goes up every year. And so, some years you have a big year, but, you know, and then. But with modern, it's too much like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man,
yeah,
you're speaking my language.
It's so funny. So I actually had this conversation over the weekend with a friend who comes on the pod every now and then around this exact topic. And with the Super Bowl so close, I brought up the fact that a Brock Purdy rookie card a couple weeks ago sold for like $150,000. And the conversation was around, this is gambling. Like, This friend is very much into kind of ultra modern. He does dabble in vintage, but I was like, you know, this is crazy. I can't believe someone would spend that. And then he just looked me dead in the eyes and he was just like, Larry, he's gambling. He took a gamble. He could afford that risk and he took the gamble flat out. There aren't many people in the world that, yes, can drop $150,000 in a card, but this particular person can, and he gambled on it. And then it made me think, I'm like, well, yeah, I guess that makes sense because people gamble on the Super Bowl, and there are plenty of people that drop $150,000 on the Super Bowl, right? So it is gambling. So you definitely hit the nail on the head with that one, Michael. All right, so there's a question that we ask all of our guests, and we're getting close to kind of time here. We want to give you time to talk a bit more about your service, but before we get to that, I would like to know, me and Nick and the audience would like to know, if you could have coffee or a beer or, you know, dinner, spend a couple hours with a sports figure who's either deceased or alive, who would it be and why?
Okay, this person is alive. Sports figure is very broad. This person is not an athlete, but he is very heavily, you know, invested in the sports world. And his name is Michael Rubin, who's the CEO of Fanatics. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting what he's doing because, and I don't know if you guys saw a couple weeks ago, the New York Times did a big article on the Fanatics, and I was in there. There was a picture of me. I was quoted in there. And I said that, you know, he's taken over the world. And a lot of people may not like it because they don't think monopolies are good. And generally speaking, you know, that's true. But I don't look at this as a monopoly. I look at, like, Topps Baseball Card Company that was acquired by Fanatics like a year and a half ago. For decades, there was no innovation. It's the same every year. Okay, we're going to print these cards on this date. We're going to send them out to these card shops and like rinse and repeat for 30 years. And no, he is innovating. The marketing, I bet either next year or the year after, you're going to see, and me too, are going to see a Super Bowl commercial of Fanatics and saying, don't forget, next week, buy your football cards coming out. You know, it's going to happen. World Series too. There's been no marketing in this hobby. Think about that. It's going to start to happen because of Fanatics. So he's the person I love to meet.
Oh, ooh. Yeah. I mean, he wants to 10X the hobby. He's definitely already 10X'd the marketing in the hobby. What he's done, I mean, it's incredible with the Brady commercial a couple months ago maybe. But yeah, I think that's a great one. Nick, have we heard Michael Rubin yet? I think it's the first time.
Definitely the first time.
That is the first.
That's great, yeah. Though. It'd be cool to pick, mm-hmm, his brain. I mean, mm-hmm, LZ and I made some predictions in an earlier podcast this year, and a lot of them revolved around Fanatics. One of our bold predictions was that they sign MJ and maybe get him. I the possibilities are endless, right? You could get him to sign 23 of the 86 Fleers that they stick in packs, right? That'd be insane. Imagine the breaks for that, right? So it's cool. Like, I'm now... things like that are possible. Like, Panini would never do that, so we wouldn't even make that bet or even think that was possible. But now that Fanatics is involved, it's kind of like, well, this could get interesting.
And you know what's cool is even just the three of us, right? Nick, to your point, the fact that Panini would have never done this, so we never would have even thought about it. Here we are, the three of us, having a conversation, like all of us, like, dreaming big about what could happen in the hobby. And that, like, didn't exist 2 years ago. So you think about how many other people are dreaming up all these ideas that maybe Fanatics will do. I think that alone is bringing so much excitement to the hobby space.
Definitely.
Yeah, and Fanatics has hired some great executives, very smart. And so, you know, we're still in the very, very early stages to see, you know, what's going to happen. But I think it's all positive.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. All right. So, Michael, we promised the audience, you know, some ways to get in touch with you. So I guess first off, how can they follow you on Instagram? And then second off, you know, if they want to get something appraised or get your opinion on their collection, how can they reach out to you and what's the best way?
Yeah, on Instagram, my handle is at Sports Appraisals, and my website is baseballinthattic.com. You can email me, michael@baseballinthattic.com, or fill out the contact form on the website. But I'm pretty accessible. I try, and I also have a calendar on my website where I sometimes, so people can, you know where I'm going to be. I don't update it very regularly, but I know next month I'll be in LA, and then, and also New Jersey and New York. And then I think April is Florida and South Carolina. So, yeah.
You know, it'd be cool if you, you rolled up to some of the bigger card shows. Like if you were at the National and you put up a little, hey, what's up? I mean, obviously you wouldn't be able to do everything there. It'd be too much volume, but you could like pick and choose maybe five or six things and like appraise some stuff. That'd be kind of fun, you know, not to put ideas in your head, but.
So I set up at the National every year. I only do one show a year, and that's the National. Mm-hmm. Cause I'm just too busy otherwise. And, you know, it gets cumbersome because you have 500 people that want to know what the value of something is. And I, like, you know, I don't have a free service, right? Like I'm not just like, you know, I have to monetize that. And so being at a card show is not a good way usually for me to monetize what I do. Because people will just walk by and say, hey, you know, so I just don't like it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You want to be going to Tokyo and checking out $100 million collections. That's more fun anyway.
Great sushi.
I could see you up on stage at the National though, Michael. I think that would be a pretty cool thing for the audience to sit in and listen. So maybe we'll convince you. Maybe me and Nick will try to work you over, get you to that.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I learned a lot in this episode. So thank you. Just this whole, you know, society of appraisers and how you got there and what you do with PSA. And it's pretty wild, but it's also a really important part of the hobby. Like, I don't think everybody understands the need for insurance like they should. They have a valuable asset that's just, it's like cash, basically. It's gone. If somebody possesses it and they're out the door, it's just like a stack of cash. It's gone. So you need to be able to protect your risk there. And I think you have a valuable service that helps insurance companies do that for the audience. So I hope that you get some of them to reach out to you. And, you know, I'm personally going to use you at some point. I know I've been busy, but, you know, thanks again for dropping this knowledge on us.
You're very welcome. Yeah, it's a lot of people don't realize this, but they're going to be forced to get an appraisal because more and more insurance companies are now requiring it. Pre-COVID, you could just tell your insurance carrier anything. Now they've gotten a lot smarter. And, you know, I get every year more and more calls that are saying, you know, my insurance provider, I've been with them for 30 years. They told me that I have 6 months to get an appraisal. Otherwise, I got to find someone else. But even so, a lot, and I'll leave you guys with just one quick short story from last year's National. So, you know, I'm set up at a booth and people would walk by with those, you know, Zion cases, right? And so I would say, you know, I'd call some people over and say, hey, you know, what's your name? You know, show me what's inside. But wow, you know, these like, you know, 16-year-old kids that have like $200,000, you know, collections. And then sometimes there were older adults. But it didn't matter who I talked to or what the value was. I would ask them, I'm like, so is this stuff insured? And they would look at me like I am a crazy person. Like, what? We're at the National and you're asking me if like this stuff is insured? Like, who are you? Why are you here? Like, get out of my face. Like, they just didn't understand. Like, but I'm telling you, those people in the next 12 to 24 months are going to find me and say, oh, you're right. Like, I should probably, you know, get this appraised so I can insure it.
Well, it's good business for you. It's going to drum up business. So,
excellent. Well, Michael, thank you again. I'm sure some people will be reaching out to you, but this was great. Thank you.
Thanks guys. Michael. I appreciate it.
All right, everyone. That was another episode of Sports Card Madness. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this episode, please take a few seconds and subscribe wherever you get them, and we'll keep them coming. Thanks, everyone.